Hi, can y'all hear me?
Lueur dans le ciel vert, éclairé trop blanc. Couche le poids dans la terre, respire le vent.
Yeah.
be checkered. We got this whole wide world. We got this whole wide world. We got this whole wide world. We got this whole wide world.
Welcome to High-Waisted Modernists with DJ Georgie Girl, the blue-haired hippie. Sit back, relax, unwind. Let the library music and spoken word ambiance wash all your cares away. Was generally, as he expressed it, on the go. He took cross-country trips by train, New York to Miami, Miami to Seattle, that sort of thing, always on a slow train, one that made frequent stops. Accommodation on these trains is limited. Though he did engage the best, Grand often had to be satisfied with a small compartment, fitted with scarcely more than the essentials of comfort. But he accepted this cheerfully, and so today, on a summer afternoon at precisely 2:05, it was with buoyant step, considering his girth, for at 53 now he was rather stout, that he climbed aboard the first Pullman of the Portland Plower, found his compartment, and began the pleasant routine of settling in for the long, slow journey to New York. As was his habit, he immediately rang the porter to bring round a large bottle of Campari and a bottle of finely iced water. Then he sat down at his desk to write business letters. Thank you. it was known that for any personal service, Grand was inclined to tip generously. And because of this, there were usually three or four porters loitering in the corridor nearby. They kept a sharp eye on the compartment door, in case Grand should signal some need or other. And as the train pulled out of the station, they could hear him moving about inside, humming to himself and shuffling papers to and fro on his desk. Before the train made its first stop, however, they would have to scurry, for Grand's orders were that the porter should not be seen when he came out of his compartment, and he did come out at every stop. At the first of these stops, which was not long in occurring, Grand went quickly to the adjoining day coach and took a seat by the window. There he was able to lean out and observe the activity on the platform. He attracted little attention himself, resembling as he did with his pleasant red face any honest farmer. From the train window, one could see over and beyond the station the rest of the small New England town, motionless now in the summer afternoon, like a toy mausoleum, while all that seemed to live within the town was being skillfully whipped underground and funneled up again in swift urgency onto the station platform, where small square cartons were unloaded from a central car. But amidst the confusion and haste on the platform, there was one recognisable figure. This was the man who sold hot dogs from a box he carried strapped to his neck. "They're red hot," he cried repeatedly, walking up and down parallel to the train and only a foot from it, while Grand, after a minute of general observation, focused all his attention on this person. And then, at exactly 1 minute before departure, he began his case with the hot dog man. "Red hot!" he shouted. And when the man reached the window, Grand eyed him shrewdly for a second, squinting, as though perhaps appraising his character, before asking tight-lipped, "How much?" 80 cents, the hot dog man said hurriedly, for the train was about to pull out. Mustard and relish, they're red hot. Done, said Grant, with a sober nod. And as the train actually began to move forward, and the hot dog man to walk rapidly in keeping abreast of the window, Guy Grand leaned out and handed him a $500 bill. Break this, he asked tersely. The hot dog man, in trying to utilize all their remaining time, passed the hot dog to Grand and reached into his change pocket before having looked carefully at the bill, so that by the time he made out its denomination, he was running almost full tilt, grimacing oddly and shaking his head, trying to return the bill with one hand and recover the hot dog with the other. During their final second together, with the hot dog man's last overwhelming effort to reach his outstretched hand, Grand reached into his own coat pocket and took out a colourful plastic animal mask. Today it was that of Pig, which he quickly donned before beginning to gorge the hot dog through the mouth of the mask, at the same time reaching out frantically for the bill. Somehow to keep it just beyond his fingers' grasp, and continuing with this while the distance between them lengthened hopelessly until at last the hot dog man stood exhausted on the end of the platform, still holding the 500 and staring after the vanishing train. When Grand finally drew himself back from the window and doffed his pig mask, it was to face a middle-aged woman across the aisle who was twisted halfway around in her seat, observing Grand with a curiosity so intense that the instant of their eyes actually meeting did not seem to register with her. Then she coughed and glanced away, but irresistibly back again as Guy Grand rose, all smiles, to leave the day coach, giving the woman a wink of affectionate conspiracy as he did. "Just having a laugh with that hot Frank vendor," he explained. "No real harm done, surely." He returned to his compartment then, where he sat at the desk sipping his Campari, a drink the colour of raspberries, but bitter as gall, and speculating about the possible reactions of the hot dog man. Thank you. outside the compartment, even at the far end of the corridor, the idle porters could often hear his odd chortle as he stirred about inside. By the time the train reached New York, Guy Grand had gone through this little performance 4 or 5 times. Curious fellow. Out of the grey granite morass of Wall Street rises one building like a heron of fire, soaring up in blue-white astonishment. Number 18 Wall, a rocket of glass and blinding copper. It is the Grand Investment Building, perhaps the most contemporary business structure in our country, known in circles of high finance simply as Grands. Offices of Grands are occupied by companies which deal in mutual funds, giant and fantastic corporations whose policies define the shape of nations. August Guy Grand himself was a billionaire. He had 180 million cash deposit in New York banks, and this ready capital was, of course, but a part of his gross holdings. Grand's associates, wealthy men themselves, saw nothing extraordinary about him. A reticent man of simple tastes, they thought, a man who had inherited most of his money and had preserved it through large safe investments in steel, rubber, and oil. What his associates managed to see in Grand was usually a reflection of their own dullness. A club member, a dinner guest, a possibility, a threat. A man whose holdings presented a prospect and a danger. But this was to do injustice to Grant's private life, because his private life was atypical. For one thing, he was the last of the big spenders, and for another, he had a very unusual attitude towards people. He spent about $10 million a year in, as he expressed it himself, making it hot for them. Grand had a thick trunk and a large balding bullet head. His face was quite pink, so that in certain half-lights he looked like a fat radish man, though not displeasingly so, for he always sported well-cut clothes and near the throat a diamond the size of a nickel, a diamond now that caught the late afternoon sun in a soft spangle of burning colour when Guy stepped through the soundless doors of Gran's and into the blue haze of the almost empty street, past the huge doorman appearing larger than life in gigantic livery, he who touched his cap with quick but easy reverence. "Cab, Mr. Grant?" "Thank you, no, Jason," said Guy. "I have the car today." And with a pleasant smile for the man, he turned adroitly on his heel, north towards Worth Street. Guy Grant's gait was brisk indeed, small, sharp steps rising on the toes. It was the gait of a man who appears to be snapping his fingers as he walks. Half a block on, he reached the car, though he seemed to have a momentary difficulty in recognising it. Beneath the windshield wiper lay a big parking ticket, which Gran slowly withdrew, regarding it curiously. "Looks like you've got a ticket, bub," said a voice somewhere behind him. His eye, Grant perceived the man in a dark summer suit, leaning idly against the side of the building nearest the car. There was something terse and smug in the tone of his remark, a sort of nasal piousness. "Yes, so it seems," mused Grant, without looking up, continuing to study the ticket in his hand. "How much will you eat it for?" he asked then, raising a piercing smile at the man. "How's that, mister?" demanded the latter, with a nasty frown, pushing himself forward a bit from the building. Grand cleared his throat and slowly took out his wallet, a long, slender wallet of such fine leather it would have been limp as silk had it not been so chock full of thousands. "I asked, what would you take to eat it? You know." Wide-eyed, he made a great chewing motion with his mouth, holding the ticket up near it. The man, glaring, took a tentative step forward. "Say, I don't get you, mister." We'll be right back. drawled Grand, chuckling down at his fat wallet, browsing about in it. Simple enough, really. And he took out a few thousand. I have this ticket, as you know, and I was just wondering if you would care to eat it for, say, a quick glance to ascertain, $6,000. What do you mean, eat it? Demanded the dark-suited man in a kind of snarl. Say, what are you anyway, bub, a wise guy? Wise guy or grand guy, call me anything you like, as long as you don't call me late for chow, eh? Grand rounded it off with a jolly chortle, but was quick to add unsmiling, how about it, pal? Got a taste for the easy green? The man, who now appeared to be openly angry, took another step forward. Listen, mister, he began in a threatening tone, half clenching his fists. I think I should warn you, said Grant quietly, raising one hand to his breast, that I am armed. Huh? Seemed momentarily dumbfounded, staring down in dull rage at the six bills in Grand's hand. Then he partially recovered, and cocking his head to one side, regarded Grand narrowly, in an attempt at shrewd scepticism, still heavily flavoured with indignation. Just who do you think you are, mister? Just what is your game? Grand's the name, Easy Green's the game, said Guy with a twinkle. Play along? He brusquely flicked the corners of the six crisp bills, and they crackled with a brittle, compelling sound. Listen, muttered the man, tight-lipped, flexing his fingers and exhaling several times in angry exasperation. Are you trying to tell me that you'll give $6,000 to eat that? He pointed stiffly at the ticket in Guy's hand. To eat that ticket? That's about the size of it, said Grant. He glanced at his watch. It's what you might call a limited offer, expiring in, let's say, 1 minute. Listen, mister, said the man between clenched teeth, if this is a gag, so help me. He shook his head to show how serious he was. No threats, Guy cautioned, or I'll shoot you in the temple. Well, what say? 48 seconds remaining. Let's see that goddamn money, exclaimed the man, quite beside himself now, grabbing at the bills. Grand allowed him to examine them as he continued to regard his watch. 39 seconds remaining, he announced solemnly. Shall I start the big countdown? Without waiting for the latter's reply, he stepped back and, cupping his hands like a megaphone, began dramatically intoning, 28, 27, 26, while the man made several wildly gesticulated and incoherent remarks before seizing the ticket, ripping off a quarter of it with his teeth, and beginning to chew, eyes blazing. Grand warmly, breaking off the countdown to step forward and give the chap a hearty clap on the shoulder and hand him the 6,000. You needn't actually eat the ticket, he explained. I was just curious to see if you had your price. He gave a wink and a tolerant chuckle. Most of us have, I suppose, hey? And with a grand wave of his hand, he stepped inside his car and sped away, leaving the man in the dark summer suit standing on the sidewalk, staring after him, fairly agog. Grand drove leisurely up the East River Drive to a large and fine old house in the 60s where he lived with his two elderly aunts, Agnes and Esther Edwards. He found them in the drawing room when he arrived. "There you are, Guy," said Agnes Edwards with tart affection, who at 86 was a year senior to Esther and held the initiative in most things between them. "Guy, Guy, Guy," exclaimed Esther happily in her turn, with a really beautiful pink smile for him. But she insisted then upon raising her teacup, so that all to be seen now was her brow, softly clouded as ever in maternal concern for the boy. Chronically troubled that Guy at 53 was unmarried, though perhaps each in her way would have fought against it. Guy beamed at them from the doorway, then crossed to kiss both before going to his big sofa chair by the window where he always sat. "We're just having tea, darling, do," insisted his Aunt Agnes with brittle passion, flourishing her little silver service bell in a smart tinkle and presenting her half-upturned face for his kiss, as though to receive it perfunctorily, but with eyelids closed and tremoring when noticed, and a second very thin hand, which, as in reflex, started to rise towards their faces, wavering up, clenched white as the lace at her wrist. "Guy! Guy! Guy!" cried Esther again, sharpening her own gaiety as she set her cup down, quickly enough, but with a care that gave her away. "You will take tea, won't you, my guy?" said Agnes, and she conveyed it in a glance to the maid who'd appeared. Giving his aunt such a smile of fanatic brightness that they both squirmed a bit. He was in good spirits now after his trip, but soon enough, as the women could well attest, he would fall away from them, lapse into mystery behind his great grey Financial Times and Wall Street Journal for hours on end. Distrait, they thought, never speaking, certainly, answering, yes, but most often in an odd and distant tone that told them nothing. Nothing. "Guy," Agnes Edwards began, turning her cup in her hand and forcing one of the warm, playful frowns used by the extremely rich to show the degree of seriousness felt. "Yes, Aunt Agnes," said Guy, unnecessarily, even brightly, actually coming forward a bit on his chair, not turning his own cup, but fingering it, politely nervous. "Guy, you know Clemence's young man. Well, I think they want to get married, and, oh, I don't know, I was just wondering if we couldn't help. Naturally, I haven't said a thing to her about it. I wouldn't dare, of course. But then, what's your feeling on it, Guy? Surely there's something we can do, don't you agree?" Grand could have no notion what she was talking about, except that it was undoubtedly a question of money. But he spoke darkly enough to suggest that he was weighing his words with care. "Why, I should think so. Yes." Agnes Edwards beamed and raised her cup in a gesture both coy and smug. Then the two women glanced at each other, smiling prettily, almost lifting their brows. Whatever it was a certain gain all around. Grant's own idea of what he was doing, making it hot for people, had formed crudely, literally, and almost as an afterthought, when early one summer morning in 1938, just about the time the Spanish Civil War was ending, he flew out to Chicago and within an hour of arrival purchased a property on one of the busiest corners of the Loop. He had the modern two-story structure torn down, and the debris cleared off that day, that very morning in fact, by a demolition crew of 50 men and machines. expected the six carpenters, who had been on standby since early morning, when they had thrown up a plank barrier at the sidewalk, to construct the wooden forms for a concrete vat of the following proportions. 15 feet square, 5 feet deep. This construction was done in an hour and a half, and it seemed that the work, except for pouring the concrete, was ended. In fact, the carpenters had put on their street clothes and were ready to leave, when after a moment of reflection, Grand assembled them with a smart order to take down this present structure and to rebuild it, but on a 2-foot elevation, giving clearance beneath, as he explained to the foreman, to allow for the installation of a heating apparatus there. "That'll make it hot for them," he said. But he wasn't speaking to the foreman then, nor apparently to anyone else. It was mid-afternoon, and collecting from the flux of the swollen summer street were the spectators, who hung in bunches at the sturdy barrier, gatherings in constant change, impressed in turn by the way the great man from the east snapped his commands, expensively dressed as he was, shirt turned back at the cuff. And when the work was going ahead correctly, Grand might give the crowd a moment of surveillance from where he stood in the centre of the lot, finally addressing them, hands cupped to his mouth as if he had to shout, though actually they were only a few yards away. "Tomorrow," he would say, "back tomorrow, now getting it ready." When an occasional wiseacre could get his attention and attempt some joke as to what was going on there behind the barrier, Grand Guy Grand would smile wearily and shake a scolding finger at him. "Now getting it ready," he would shout slowly, or something else equally irrelevant to the wiseacre's jibe. But no one took offence, either because of not understanding or else because of the dignity and bearing of the man and the big diamond he wore at his throat. A truck of sand and gravel and 6 sacks of quick drying cement arrived at the working site at 2 o'clock, but were forced to wait until the new forms were complete. Then a sheet of metal was lowered into place and the concrete was poured into the forms. Under Grand's spirited command, it was all so speedily done that well before dusk the work was ended, including the installation of a great gas burner there. Star-shaped with 1,000 dark jets, like a giant upturned squid stretched beneath the structure. It was apparent now that when the board forms were removed, the whole would resemble a kind of white stone bath, set on 4 short columns, with a heating apparatus beneath, and small ramps leading up the vat on each of its sides. Before dinner, Guy Grand completed arrangements begun earlier in the day with the Chicago stockyards. These provided for the delivery of 300 cubic feet of manure, 100 gallons of urine and 50 gallons of blood to an address in the suburbs. grand met them there and had the whole stinking mess transferred to a covered dump truck he had purchased that morning. These arrangements cost Grant a pretty penny, because the stockyards do not ordinarily conserve or sell urine, so that it had to be specially collected. After securing the truck's cover, Grand climbed into the cab, drove back towards the stockyard, and parked the truck there, where the stench of it would be less noticeable. Then he took a taxi into town, to the near north side, and had a quiet dinner at the Drake. At 9 o'clock, while it was still light, he returned to the working site, where he was met by some of the crew, and saw to the removal of the board forms and the barrier. He inspected the vat and the burner below, which he tested and found in good working order. Then he dismissed the crew and went back to his hotel. He sat at his desk writing business letters until his thin gold wrist clock sounded 3 a.m. Exactly then, he put away his writing things, freshened himself up, and just before leaving the room paused near the door and collected a big leather briefcase, a gas mask, a wooden paddle, a bucket of black paint, and an old stiff paintbrush. He went downstairs and took a cab out to the place where he had parked the dump truck. Leaving the cab, he got into the truck and drove back to the working site. There he backed the truck carefully up one of the ramps and then emptied all that muck into the vat. The stench was nearly overpowering, and Grand, as soon as he had parked the truck and gotten out of it, was quick to don the gas mask he had brought. Stepping up one of the ramps, he squatted on the parapet of the vat and opened the briefcase, out of which he began taking a handful at a time and dropping into the vat $10,100 bills, slowly stirring them in with his wooden paddle. And he was in this attitude, squatting at the edge of the vat, gas mask covering his face, stirring with his paddle and dumping bills into the muck, the work only half begun, when a passing police patrol car pulled up to investigate the activity and, above all, the stench. But before the officers could properly take account, Grant had closed the briefcase, doffed his mask, given them $5,000 each, and demanded to be taken at once to their precinct captain. After a few hushed words between them and a shrugging of shoulders, they agreed. At the station, Grand spoke privately with the captain, showing him several business cards and explaining that it was all a harmless promotion stunt for a new product. Naturally, my firm is eager to cooperate with the authorities, he said, and handed the captain $25,000. And so it was finally agreed that Grant might return to the site and proceed, as long as whatever he was doing did not involve criminal violence within the precinct. Moreover, while the captain could make no definitive promise about it, he was attentive enough to Grant's proposal of an additional $50,000 on the following noon, if the police would be kept away from the site for a few hours that morning. "Think it over," said Grant pleasantly. "Better sleep on it, eh?" Back at the site, Grand Guy donned his mask again and dumped the remaining contents of the briefcase into the vat. Stepped down, opened the can of paint, gave it a good stirring, and finally, using his left hand so that what resulted looked childish or illiterate, he scrawled across the vat, "Free dollar here," in big black letters on the sides facing the street. He climbed up for a final check on the work. Of the bills in the muck, the corners, edges, and denomination figures of about 500 were visible. After a moment, he stepped down and, half crouching beneath the vat, took off his mask and saw to his burners. He did a short, terse countdown and turned the valve full open. Then he removed the handle so that it could not easily be interfered with. As he touched off the match, the 1,000 flames sprang up, all blue light, and broke back, doubling on the metal plate and on the wet concrete, a colour of sand in summer moonlight. One of those chosen instants lost to childhood, damp places in reflection, surface of cement under the earth, the beautifully cool buried places. The stench became unbearable. He stood and quickly donned his mask, turned away from the sight, and walked across the street, where he paused at the corner and surveyed the hole. Already in the pale eastern light, the moronic scrawl, "Free dollar here," loomed with convincing force, while below the 1,000 flames beat up, blue-white and strangely urgent for this hour of mourning on a downtown corner of Chicago. "Say," mused Grand, half aloud, "that'll make it hot for them all right." and he leapt into the big dump truck and drove like the wind back to his hotel. At dawn, he caught the plane for New York. The commotion that occurred a few hours later on that busy corner of the loop in downtown Chicago was the first, and in a sense perhaps, the most deliberately literal of such projects, eventually to be linked with the name of Grand Guy. Guy Grand provoking the wrath of the public press against him, and finally earning him the label eccentric, and again towards the end, crackpot. Been listening to High Waisted Modernists with me, DJ Gigi, the blue-haired hippie. Check out the archives at wfmu.org/playlists/HW.
Oh, say can you see, and the home
The following program is intended for mature audiences.
Live from Sheena's Jungle Room, a service of freeform and listener-supported WFMU, you're where the action is. I'm Jeffrey Holasgo. Good afternoon.
Insanity. I ask myself, More music.